Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health. Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. Today we have one of the most anticipated episodes by me, mainly, rather than anybody else. We have Tracy Jewell with us. How are you, Tracy?
I'm so excited to be here.
Now, for the record, I have spent at least 15 minutes talking heavily about Married at First Sight. That was probably one of the only seasons that I watched really intensely with my husband. So I was fangirling just a little bit. So Tracy's from, she's well known from being on Married at First Sight. What year was it in, Tracy?
It was 2018. Yeah, it's been a long time.
So what have you been up to since going on the show in 2018?
It's funny how life is all about stages and phases. So I was lucky after MAFS, I found my husband, who we went to school with. I actually dated him in high school, so I knew him before MAFS. And we hit it off and had our son, Frankie, in 2021. So our son is 4. And how I've kind of been really embraced by the neurodivergent community is last year at the age of 3, our son was diagnosed with ADHD and autism. And then through that journey, I got diagnosed and my husband is going through the process now. So we are very much a neurospicy family. And I have to say that throughout everything I've been through in the public eye, this is the most supportive community I have ever come across.
I had the similar thing with my children getting diagnosed. And then, you know, where does it come from? I initially looked at my husband like, well, it's all your fault. It's all your side. Do you mind me asking, have you been diagnosed as autistic and ADHD or is it the one?
Yes, I've been diagnosed with both. And it's so funny because nothing was new to me. It was just a confirmation and a validation of something that I'd never fit in. I always blamed being adopted or something else as the cause. My parents got me to see child psychologists thinking it's bipolar or, you know, it's an eating disorder or social anxiety, and none of those boxes fit. So now I'm like, see, Mum, I told you.
Oh, it's so funny because I did this similar thing. We went, you know, down the therapy road very early. And I had a very stable upbringing, so I didn't really have anything to air quote blame. Not that you're blaming, but you know what I mean by that, right? And anyway, you know, the bipolar, the eating disorder and all of these things. But then when I was receiving therapy, it was like, well, none of this is helping. There's something innately wrong with me. Did you have the same experience?
I always felt like the odd one out my whole life. And like a lot of us women, I just totally masked. I was great at school. I was able to fit in. I was able to go out to parties and no one would ever know, but I would come home and cry and find any excuse to get out of a social situation. And it was hard work for me to get along with people. I would have to, you know, write in my phone a list of questions I could ask. I was prepared to keep my anxiety at bay. All these signs and symptoms, I just had no idea what was really going on.
That's so interesting. I have a very close friend, and this is before the kids were diagnosed, and it was the first time I'd ever seen her. She came over, she was nervous about something. She wrote out a full script for this phone call that was like, it was really not a big deal. So she wrote this script about what they said and what she would say, and it was like this whole mind map, right? And then she finally rang them, and I had to sit with her, and I was like, this is really painful. And then when she rang them, they of course didn't pick up, right? So then when they actually called back, the ADHD side of it had like taken over, and then she lost the script that we'd spent an hour and a half working on. And it was only like now that I look back and I'm like, that was so a dual diagnosis of autism and ADHD right there. And, you know, late after that, she was diagnosed about 5 years later. But some of those things that you do, you just see it so clearly afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I would ruminate with every interaction on the drive home and just ruminate what I said, what they said. How did it come across? And just missing those social cues. I'd always interrupt everyone. And just all this stuff that I just think, why am I like this? It's almost like, especially with ADHD, you can't stop the way you are. You're just blurting it out all the time. And it's so validating. I find diagnosis a really powerful tool because now I don't have the shame and the self-esteem and the self-worth because it's just my brain works differently and that's so okay. And also for our children, I think I've got to become okay with this and accept this because what am I going to teach my son and his friends and the community at large if I'm always trying to hide this stuff?
Oh, absolutely. I love that, because when I was diagnosed as autistic, it took me about a year to actually say that on the podcast. I started off saying I've got a few traits, and, you know, like, you eventually like step in past that imposter syndrome. But I ended up coming out publicly because I thought, well, what message am I sending to my children? If I say I don't tell anybody, well, why? And then I say, don't be ashamed of it. That doesn't make sense, because you kind of have to embrace it for your child to embrace it. You can't go, oh, you should embrace it, but I'm going to hide over here and not tell anybody.
Exactly. I'll give you an example. So I have ARFID, which is, for those that don't know, avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. Again, my parents thought I had anorexia, but it was never about wanting to lose weight or how I looked. I just had so many food sensitivities. Everything had to be a particular way beyond fussy eating for me to eat. I still have it to this day, and I have therapy. And that was the hardest part for me to kind of get over and accept, because my son has it too. And I thought to myself, if I don't get help with this, how am I going to help him? How is he ever going to learn the skills and the tools if I don't start first? Because we're role models with that co-regulation piece, right?
Oh, I completely agree. I think ARFID is still a funny one for me. I'm very confident I would be diagnosed with ARFID. But I remember meeting my husband, and I was 28, and he said to me, let's get a pizza. And I said, oh, I don't like pizza. And he goes, oh, have you had pizza? I said, no, I've never had a pizza. And he's like, so how do you know you don't like it? I'm like, I just know. And I eventually ate a pizza. I think maybe we've been together a year, and it's now one of my favorite foods. But I always talk to my kids about, like, it took me 29 years to eat a pizza, and it's now my favorite food. Like, it's a great way to embrace how you feel, to get connect with them. Like, I get it's hard, but actually, what are you missing out on? Like, even to talk to them in ways that you connect with them.
Oh, that's so true. And I think these kids are sometimes so sensitive. They can pick up if you're genuine or not. Mm. If you're just saying, oh, that's so hard, but you don't really mean it, that's not going to help them co-regulate. Where if you're like, I really get it, I struggle with this, I think they can feel that genuineness. So especially around food, where, you know, I don't like sauces on my things. I like my sauce on the side, and I don't even touch the sauce, not a condiment person. And being able to show that it's okay, but you know what, mummy's going to try it. And it's really hard for me to try it. It comes from a so different place. And I can see my son opening up to that. And I think that's different than pretending all the time to try and relate to them and connect with them in a superficial way.
Oh, I completely agree, because you don't want to have a family being like, we are all completely air quoting normal, and then you're that child with that problem over there. Like, if you other a child, it's going to be very difficult in any situation to build connection with them enough to even get them to try different food, or even just be there with you, holding your hand in the supermarket, walking around going, I might like to try that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's normalizing it. These things are really hard, but you know what? We find other things that are easy. Like, my son will sit there with dominoes and colors and blocks and jigsaws and just sort the F out of them. Like, he is amazing. Things will be sorted in our house and organized. And I love organization. Give me a couple of drawers and things, and I will just excel and hyper-focus in that stuff. So I think, you know, we focus on everything we can't do, or what we struggle with, or what our kids can't do. And we forget to celebrate what we're really good at. And I think you can also find connection in your similarities as well, and your wins.
Oh, absolutely. I love that you said that. I've got an autistic friend. She was pregnant, and she's got two autistic kids. And she was like terrified that her baby coming might be neurotypical. She was like, oh, I'm just so worried. Like, what will I do with that child? Because, you know, there is that chance that child might be neurotypical. And I just love the way that we had this chat about what you would possibly do, and like dreading a neurotypical birth, because she's like, what will I do if my child wants to, like, is really social and wants to hang out with people all the time, and they want to say goodbye to everybody, and I just want to leave? And, you know, we were having this chat around how she would parent a neurotypical child. And it was the most interesting discussion, because I was like, I love the narrative that's being flipped, that it's not about, oh, what can we do to reduce the chances of a child being autistic? But we had a conversation for a long time about how could we reduce the chance it might be neurotypical. And I thought, this is so great.
So funny, because my daughter, who's now 15, is neurotypical and is such a social butterfly, loves sport, loves, you know, as 15-year-olds, they love anything. But the way we connect is through music, where we can both sit in the car and go for a long drive and not talk and just sing our favorite songs because we both have the skill of remembering lyrics. So even with neurotypical, you can still find ways to connect and similarities, and you don't have to hide what you struggle with. Like my daughter laughs that, you know, I love one-on-one time with her and we're never going to go and hang out in a whole group of people. Like it's just not going to happen. And you can get that at school. We don't need to do that at home. And we have a chuckle about it. We don't take it all too seriously.
But then how great is it for her to, for her to grow up already knowing inclusion? Like the way that you have just described that is such a beautiful way of how to talk about inclusion, because there is a lot of neurotypical parents, they think, that have got neurodiverse children. Like there's a child with a problem in my home, but to be like, I actually am neurotypical, my child's neurodivergent, and it's amazing. Because you've just flipped that on its head completely, that there is, you don't need to have the same neurotype as a family, because of course, as a mum, you love whatever child you get. Of course you do.
And I think, you know, you do have to accept that things are different. That doesn't mean other, but yes, like there are some days my son has pathological demand avoidance and we need a low demand lifestyle. And sometimes our plans need to go out the window and we have to have those conversations with my daughter. It's like, you know what, today, great for me, it's just going to be us going out. Frankie's having a bit of a tough time. Now that doesn't mean he's over there and other. That's not the way we treat it. We're like, well, Frankie gets to have a great time with dad today. We always try and reframe it in that positive. So I think we have to accept the way things are, but you can always put it on a positive spin. So no one feels like they're missing out, or those emotions of shame have to come into it, or guilt, right?
Oh, I love that. And you know, one of the best things that I did with my kids, which you've illustrated so beautifully there, is I've talked to them about how true equality is not actually people getting the same thing. That's not the way the world works. So if we have a child that is having a hard time, like you talked about, they may get something extra that day. They may get half an hour more on their iPad. They may sleep in our bed for longer. We've got another child that might eat alone with a screen because that's what that child needs that day. And even though we have children of different ages, that doesn't mean that it's going to be linear in the way that they can get ready for school, do their homework, go to bed. Everybody is working on something different. And it's been so good because it has reduced some of those feelings around things not being fair. It's always about them. And it's like, it's actually not. It's about giving everybody what they need.
Yes, and not fitting into our agenda. I know, you know, when you become a parent, especially with Grace, my daughter, and I grew up table at 7 p.m. every night, sitting around eating. I don't think, if you see my table here, we've used it once for a meal. It is literally full of admin. It's pretty much an office desk, not a dining table, right? So that was the first thing to go. So I think one of the things is very much not that linear, but also giving up some of our parental routines and expectations that we think it should look like, when that's just going to equal meltdowns, dysregulation.
So I love the way that you brought up dropping some of those parenting beliefs that we thought we had and the way that we think it should go. What do you think some of the behaviors are that get blamed as bad parenting? What do you think some of those things are? And, you know, what do you think they are on the flip side instead of?
Oh, this is such a big one, because I know, and this is not just my perspective or experience, it's talking to a lot of mums from neurodivergent families, especially when your kids get a little bit older. Like if you go to the shops and your child is having a meltdown or screaming or running away from you as a toddler, that's very different to when they get a bit older and then you start getting the looks, right? And that bad parenting looks. And I think that's when it becomes trickier. And what I thought, with similar to everyone, is when you see a child screaming, carrying on, yelling, you know, that does look like bad behavior. But then when you start to learn through therapies and education in space that, you know, they're just having such a hard time that their bucket is so full of sensory overload, they have no other way but to let it out. You can't expect a child like that in that state to be able to say, hey, mum, I'm having a hard time, or point to a visual aid, or, by the way, upset here. Like, we have all those tools. My son is verbal, but come on, like that's never going to happen.
But
right?
I can't even do that. Like I will still deny. Like if my hubby goes, you know, do you want to go for a walk? And he makes some kind of point that I may not be my best self in that moment. And he's always 100% right. I won't have it. That makes me, I'm not going to go for a walk now. But, you know, as soon as you can't expect children to point that out and understand that and then regulate themselves.
Exactly. And, you know, my son, he does kick, he does bang his head, he has these challenging behaviors. And it's really hard to try and help him because when he's like that, he's so far gone. And I feel bad because I've missed the cues before that happens. But I do realize that it's not attention-seeking behavior. He hates being like that. I can tell. He's just so overwhelmed. My only role is to just get him, let him get it out. We'll get through it. And then we'll chat about safe hands at another time. That is not the time. It's too late to be talking about safe hands. So I realize that it's not personal. It's not about me. He's not trying to get attention. He actually really needs my help in that moment together to get through it. And then we can talk about it later. And I've just reframed the whole triggers and the behaviors that come out that we don't like and that are tough for everyone. And to find a better way through it and almost like through it together. It's not me versus you. It's not I'm trying to stop the behavior. I'm just trying to find a safe way through it for everyone.
Sometimes it feels like a one-way freight train. It's like as mothers at the end of the day, I will always go, I missed the cues. I could have done that. I should have seen that coming. Sometimes I think it's just a freight train. It's coming and it doesn't really matter. Sometimes I feel like what I could have done differently because it's just, they just need to get that out somehow.
Love how you say at the end of the day, because that's when it 100% happens. And, you know, especially when they're at school and we don't see all the triggers along the way. Sometimes it can't be avoided. So we just need to be able to let it out.
Oh, absolutely. So then let's talk about then co-regulation because, you know, you're a mum who has dual diagnosis and you've got a child with dual diagnosis. And to really be emotionally available in those moments and stay regulated yourself, like how do you think you do that? Is there anything that's made that easier for you?
This is the messy part, right? When they need us to be able to regulate with them and they can't do it themselves. It's so tough. So I'm very much attachment style. I want to come and cuddle. You know, I want to make things okay by being physically there. And that makes things so much worse with the way my son is. And my husband's avoidant. He'll just stonewall, emotionally shut down, you know. And as an anxious person, it makes it so much worse for me because then I just want to cuddle him more. So I think you need to just be self-aware of how we're all these different styles. And I love something that Brené Brown said is like this check-in. So when we both come home, me and my husband will be like, well, I'm at 50% today. And he'll be like, well, I'm at 80%. So I can step up a little bit more. I have more capacity today. Or I'm like, babe, I'm at 20% right now. Like I've got nothing in the tank. So we check in to see where each other's at. So then at least one of us can pick up the slack that day to be able to help that regulation in our household. And it changes all the time, day to day, what's happened that day. And I know that if he disappears, it's not personal. He just needs a moment and he doesn't always communicate that he needs that moment. And not having judgment that we all have different styles or we're trying to pretend that we're not okay either.
And I think, you know, having someone that you can, well, having honest conversations with everyone in your house, including your child, is so important. So when there's that mismatch between what you thought you would be like as a mother and what you thought your child would be like, and then you get a different child to what you thought you'd get, which means your parenting style, your experience of being mother is different. How has that happened for you? Like, has that been something you've struggled with?
I'm going to be real honest with everyone here. This is the biggest part I still have a lot of grief about. For those that, you know, are separated or divorced, I've always shared custody of my daughter. I never got to be a full-time mom with her, right? So when we had Frankie, I finally was like, yes, I have the opportunity to be a full-time mom. This is something I've always wanted. And that's turned out, although I'm a full-time mom, completely different because I feel more like a carer than a mum half the time. So I guess my expectations with Frankie was higher because I was just so excited to be a full-time mum. And now we're spending a lot of our time that I could be at the park or, you know, at Time Zone, we're spending in therapy. So there's a lot of grief there. But I guess as a parent, you can have all those feelings of grief. Of course, I'm going to do everything I can to give him the tools and the skills he needs to live in this world, right? I'm going to do whatever I can to make him as happy and thrive and grow with his milestones, not mine. But then, yes, I do go and cry in the shower sometimes about that, because we do miss out. We do miss out a lot. We have to say no to things because of low demand and it just doesn't suit us. The amount of times we've had to cancel one thing is more times than I can count. And of course, if you don't acknowledge that it's hard and it sucks, then that's not being real, in my opinion.
So then how do you manage that kind of situation? Because you don't want to make it about that there's something wrong with the child, because there's nothing wrong with the child, but the experience that you're having isn't what you expected. And I only say these words because I have a similar feeling. It's like the grief and shame and guilt for feeling that late at night when I lay in bed and I'm like, that's not how I thought my Saturday would go. And you have ideas of what you think you were going to do, especially when you're excited and you're pregnant and it doesn't match. Do you feel that whole, like, you're not allowed to talk about that?
It is tough, especially with friends when you're a typical kid. But I also feel like it's our responsibility as a community to advocate and not lie about it. I'm really honest with the reasons why I'm not going to lie that we're sick or, you know, I think it's important to be real. And if they're real friends, they'll get it and they'll understand, or at least ask questions and be curious of sometimes how difficult it can be. And that's what real friendship is. But also, I just reframe it with our son when we're having a tricky day and we get to do something else fun. It's like, yes, for example, we just went to Bluey World and SeaWorld, right? And I refuse to just give up just because it's hard. The aeroplane was a nightmare, okay? He was hitting us for 5 hours straight. I still have the bruises. You know, like, I'm not going to lie. It was so hard and painful and we needed one at the end of it. But I am so glad we went because he had the best time once we were there. So we don't stop doing things. We just have to look at our expectations and you know what, it's going to be hard, but effort, we're going to do it anyway, because at the end of the day, there's still going to be some magic moments, even if it's not linear or it goes a certain way and there's going to be more ups and downs. I think I'd feel a lot more guilt and shame and more resentful if it actually, you know what, we'll just stay home for the whole school holidays and not do anything, right? Because I don't think that's the answer either.
Okay, so what about this one? What about how has your own neurodivergence kind of changed the way that you parent or you see the behaviours that maybe aren't ones that you desire or aren't ones that you really want to see again? How does that make you view those behaviours?
That's such an interesting one, because I think when you see your behaviour mirrored and you don't like that behaviour in yourself, whether it's your child or someone at work, that can also be quite triggering, right? Because it's like the icky part of you that you want to hide away. But then it's also quite validating. And it's so funny how ADHD and autism works the complete opposite. It's like, oh, I feel so relieved, but run away. And, you know, you feel those things both at the same time. And it comes from a place of realness and self-awareness that we're like, oh, yeah, we have that. And we call them names, like, you know, my little Lucy that likes to interrupt people comes out. And I think you just have to have a bit of fun with it, because otherwise it can get all a bit overwhelming. You know, and you get into like that sad party, right? So whenever I'm triggered or I see something in myself that my son has, we just have a bit of a laugh and a bit of cheek and call them names and accept it for what it is, right? And I think that's made me a better parent, because I'm parenting what we have, not the parenting book that I thought it was going to be.
Oh, that's so funny. I remember one of my kids, they had like a therapy plan. This is right in the beginning. And I looked at it and I was like, I don't think we need to work on any of that. That's all pretty normal. Like, that's just what kids do. That's just what people do. Like, I do that. I'm not worried about any of that. And they're like, those things are not behaviors that we want to continue, whatever it was. And I was like thinking, none of the stuff that I want to work on, I thought the therapist wanted to work on, because I thought everything they wanted to work on was completely normal. And then they had to like talk to me about how those behaviors are actually neurodiverse and these are the impacts. And I was going, okay. So then I listed about what I wanted them to work on with my child. And they were like, we see those as neurotypical behaviors that every child does. And I was like, I'm just so confused right now. Because you start to look through your own neurodiverse lens. And I was like, why do we need to work on that? I mean, I think that's great. And they couldn't understand, like we couldn't even agree on the goal.
So funny, but it's like, does it work for you? Is it hurting anyone? I get it with some of the hitting and those type of behaviors, you know, it's all about strategies to be safe, right? And safety is obviously a non-negotiable. But if I want to sort the fridge and color code it, big deal. Like if my child loves stimming and we love running around in circles and creating obstacle courses, but not actually using the obstacle course, we just like sorting it out, big deal. Like these are self-soothing behaviors that really help him. And I love creating space for all of us to do the things that fill us up, because it also means he has more capacity to learn other skills that he needs to learn, right? So if I try and put a stop on all that and the ways he wants to communicate rather than telling him how he has to communicate, he won't have the capacity to learn new skills.
I completely agree. So with their therapist, what they wanted to work on was that one of my children goes to the library every single day at lunch. Now, I defended that to the ground. Like we spent the whole time arguing about it, because I had the point of view as like, so who cares? They are happy there. They are going where their interest is. They run craft there. They have a safe teacher who's an old lady, who's like their grandma, and they sit and they do things together. And that child is 100% happy with that decision. And they wanted to build confidence so they could then interact and go to the playground and this stuff. And I'm like, but they are happy. I don't want you to put into their head that's the wrong thing to do. That's actually a really safe option that they enjoy. I go where my interests are. Like, I don't care what my friends are doing. I go with and do what I want to do. I've always been like that. And they kept telling me how that was neurodiverse. And I can see now that is a completely neurodiverse thing to do, is to go where your interest is and disregard what your friends are doing. But they wanted to teach her to prioritize a friend over an interest. And it just went against my whole core. I was like, don't you dare tell her that's wrong, because it's not wrong.
You know what? As adults, what do? We find friends in the interests that we have. Like we choose the workplace that we go to or the job we have out of an interest. So that just seems so foreign to me. And I guess that's because I'm neurodiverse, right? And I always follow my interests. But as long as they're happy.
So I was thinking, I was like, so they want to build her confidence, right? Because yeah, she did need to build her confidence. Again, I agreed with that. But I was like, if her one thing that she really likes doing at school is going to the library, and then we go ahead and tell her that she needs to build confidence to do something else, like how is that building her confidence? Because now it's like second guessing what she innately wants to do.
And you can build confidence in other ways.
And this is why I argued about it for an hour, and I just couldn't fathom that was something we needed to work on. And so it's been an interesting lens to look at my children from a neurodiverse place, because I'm like, but that actually is a skill that will actually help her later. By following interests hard, not following friendships, by what she wants to do and excelling in that is actually going to help her later. So let's not cut that out. Like I just couldn't get it.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's that balance, right? And we know our kids better than anyone. And I think therapy is great. Getting the right therapist really helps. But it doesn't mean you have to agree with everything they say. Even if you take on half of what they say, it's going to make a huge difference. But I think it stops with us, right? That gateway of, okay, that sits well for our family. I'm going to go and apply that and add it to our toolbox versus, you know what? I don't think this is a right fit for us. And I think we can make those decisions.
Oh, I agree. And it can be really tricky with multiple kids. You know, like I've been in positions where you have two in the car and they've got on iPads, you're running aircon, you're going in to drop this one in. Like it's really tricky. So it's easier said than done, but understanding what's happening in those therapy rooms, I think, is really important, because if you are unsure about some of the messaging that's happening in there, I think as a parent, we do want to know what those goals are, what they're working on, to make sure that we're backing that up at home and that we're comfortable with it. Because sometimes I would talk about dropping a child off to therapy like a hot meat pie, like you just kind of drop them off. You can't really do that and expect a good result. But it can be really tricky because it's just another thing that we've got to do on top of everything else. So, but you've got to be confident in what the therapist is doing.
Yes. And it's that balance of you don't need to be a part of everything, but you do need to have an overarching on the goals. So you're all working towards the same and be on the same page. And that's the schools as well. I feel like with therapy, you know, I need to relay that information to my husband and my mom and the school. And I feel like, you know what, I'm just going to email it. You read it.
I've actually set up G drives with like reports and everything. And now I just like send the person, I should share the G drive. I'm like, this is where we're at. Like, I'm not talking to you about it all. Like, I'm definitely not doing birth history. Like, you read that, you ring me after. That's it.
That's so funny. I need to set up a G drive. That's a great idea. Just share the folder. There you go.
Oh, I was like, if I have to go through one more time about what the pregnancy was like when they walked for the first time, like, I cannot do that. Anyway, okay, so last question. What is your response to the idea that structure at home is the answer? Do you think that structure sometimes feels impossible or, I suppose, oppressive even? Like, sometimes I feel strangled by the structure that I have to have at home. How do you think it works with having structure for kids versus it being just so boring as well?
Structure. You're talking to someone that is so ADHD and just will run from red tape and bureaucracy and structure for the hills. Like, I am a planner, but that's different to structure. And, you know, with PDA profiles, I know with some families, especially with autism, structure works really well and routine. And yes, we have some of that for the non-negotiables, like you need to brush your teeth, buddy. We need to change your nappy. Like, you know, you need to have a bath. That has to happen. We need to make sure you're fed. But you don't need to have structure with everything, because I think, you know, with so much uncertainty in these families that we have, some of us want to control to deal with it, which can make things 10 times worse. For some families it works, for ours it does not. So I had to let go of a lot of those controls and plans. I can still have my checklist, can still write my plan, they're still there, but I'm learning that to radically accept, and it's okay not to always follow the plan. And that's totally fine. And just reading it sometimes gives me a little dopamine hit, even if I'm not actioning it.
Oh, that's so funny. So you're like, I'm going to like anxiously plan and then I'm just going to let go because at least I've done that part. Is that what you mean?
It's like manifesting. Nothing manifests if you hold on to it. You need to create it and then surrender it. So planning and structure for me is the same way as I manifest. If I write it all down, but then I just have to like let it go and see what happens to the day.
Okay, so thank you so much for everything you've shared, Tracy, especially so honestly, relatable, validating way. I really appreciate your time. If anyone would like to get in touch with you, I know that you're doing some really great work over in Perth in inclusion. Do you want to just give a little bit of an overview about the work it is that you are doing, and I can pop it into the show notes as well?
I created a club, which is online and in Perth, called the Inclusive Mamas Club, because I found through my own experiences how isolating it is. And you say this all the time with mums and women who get it. So we wanted to create some peer support circles as well as some fun social events that are very sensory friendly and very flexible and very low demand. So a lot of it's free, because I know sometimes it's very difficult to be able to financially afford these things on top of everything else. And we don't need to chat about the NDIS. We all get it. So yeah, so it's Inclusive Mamas Club. So you're more than welcome to, membership is free, to reach out. And yeah, we'd love to support you any way we can.
Perfect. Okay. Well, I will put that into the show notes for anybody who would like to find out more about that. Thank you so much for your time, Tracy. Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD mum's shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au,